We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview my wonderful friend and colleague, Catherine Free, and we discuss Greek theater. Stay tuned. It is September 8th, 2023. I am with Catherine Free, and you are recently retired from being a professor at Loyola Marymount University and taught several topics there, including Greek theater.
Yes.
And I wanted to do a series where you teach me and the public about what was at one point one of the cornerstones of a liberal arts education. And now it's more difficult to find these courses.
It's true, isn't it? Somehow we're not interested in our past very much anymore. At least at this time. I'm sure it's going to come back because it's so interesting. And so maybe we'll find out tonight some of the reasons that it's worth digging into the past.
You're the person to teach me. You know, I never liked being lectured to, but I want to be lectured to
now. I'm not going to lecture. I'm going to talk to you, Peter, and your audience about one of my passions. And I've been passionate about Greek culture since I was a kid. I don't know why it struck me so as a very young child. I think it had to do with the visuals. The artwork was so fabulous and so compelling. And then when I was in high school, I read Antigone in class. That's a play by Sophocles, for the listeners, very famous play, one of the most famous Greek tragedies. And when I went to college, my teacher had just returned from Greece, my advisor. I was in theater arts, and she was the chair of the department, and she was directing Trojan Women, which is a great masterpiece of anti-war, probably one of the most powerful anti-war statements ever made. And I got cast in the role of Cassandra, and I really was thrilled to perform that play. So it sort of got its hooks in me from that point on. And at the same time, there was a revival of interest in the classics. And there was a great deal of interest in foreign cinema. And there was a Greek director, actually a Cypriot director, named Kakoyannis, who was directing Electra, and then Trojan Women, and then Iphigenia in Aulis. And these films by a Greek, with Greek actors, the great Irene Pappas was in all three of those, were absolutely stunning testaments to the enduring power of these ancient plays. Now, Greek drama really is a foundation, one of the foundations of Western culture, and maybe you could say even of world culture, because of all of the arts, of the traditional arts, I'm not talking about the new technologies, but of the traditional performing arts, and of theater is the most recent invention. You can see evidence of musical instruments coming from the Neolithic period. They found flutes that are like 10,000 years old. And they are there are cave drawings that suggest dances sometimes. And storytelling, we can imagine, goes back to the dawn of human communication. But theater, in which an audience gathers to hear a fictional story, not always fictional, sometimes it's a real story based on reality, not in a religious context, not in a strictly religious context, is really a Greek invention. So the secularization of something that perhaps once had been a ritual, it starts with the Greeks. Is it the oldest form of drama on earth? I'm not sure, but it's certainly one of the oldest. If there's anything as old or nearly as old, we can look to ancient India, which has a very, very long tradition of dramatic performance and drama and the writing of dramas. So what we have today are the skeletons of that art form. The skeletons are the theaters, the archaeological remains of the theaters, which really only appear to us substantially in the later 19th century and then into the 20th century as excavators dug up mounds of earth and restored these theaters to their glory, so that many of them are in use today for performances. And they are stunning. They're huge. They accommodate thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. The largest theater known in antiquity was around 30,000 spectators, and that is something comparable to Dodger Stadium.
And they didn't have microphones.
And that's something I can talk to you about. Furthermore, they wore masks in this theater. So you'd think that a mask wouldn't necessarily enhance sound. And there's absolutely no evidence that it did so. In the 19th century, they thought they must have had megaphones in the masks, but we know they did not.
These are called personas.
They're called prosopa. Prosopa is the Greek word for mask. Personas is Etruscan and Latin.
Okay.
It's not Greek. But the word in Greek is prosopon, and the plural is prosopa. Okay, so these masks were not enhancers of sound. They didn't magnify sound in any way. That isn't to say they impeded sound. The Greeks wouldn't have used anything that would have impeded sound, I'm sure. And it was a sung theater. It was a danced theater. And some of it was spoken. It was a combination of speech, singing, dancing. Its origins are in religion. Particularly the religion of Dionysus, who is the patron god of theater in the classical period in Athens. Although in later periods, a king could sponsor a theater, or Alexander the Great used to put plays on, and also other gods were associated with the performance of theater, depending on which festival was hiring the actors. But originally it was strictly in honor of Dionysus, the god of wine, you all know that, and also the god of ecstasy. And that's really important for understanding the nature of drama, because what is theater? What is theater? It is something in which a human being enacts another entity. Usually human, but sometimes maybe a god, maybe a ghost, but something not himself. And I use the male pronoun because there were only male actors in Athens in the classical period when this art form developed, just before the beginning of democracy, around 534 that's an approximate year, not an exact one. We're not exactly sure. It's the first time theater was ever performed in a religious festival in honor of Dionysus. It was under the last dictator of Athens, Pisistratus. And then following Pisistratus' death, his sons were driven out of Athens, and there was an assassination of one of them. And then democracy started in Athens. So it's very closely associated with democracy. And all of the plays we have from the classical period and from the early Hellenistic period are from the Athenian democracy. So it's especially, it's not just Greek, it's an Athenian art form. It starts in Athens. That's where we first discover drama, coming out of some kind of religious ceremony in honor of Dionysus, related to Dionysus in some way. He becomes the patron god of theater. The actors in later periods are known as the artists of Dionysus, when they're organized into guilds. And they are influenced by that religion in some way, in ways we don't entirely understand. Probably mask wearing comes from that religion. We see masks used in ceremonies associated with Dionysus on vase paintings. So it looks like masks maybe come from that, some religious aspect of that religion. And also probably the idea of acting, because I think it has to do with the nature of that god. The god, he's the god of ecstasy. If you are possessed by Dionysus, you are standing outside of yourself. That's what ecstasy means, ecstasis. Standing away, and you are no longer yourself. You're some other entity, namely, you're a devotee of the god. You partake of the god's nature.
And was there also a relationship to Eros or the erotic, particularly because of Dionysus and his role in that cult?
Well, there are three kinds of love. There's agape, which is used in Christianity to describe brotherly love, sisterly love, the love of friends, the love of family. There's philia, which is an intense kind of obligatory love, where you have not only feelings of warmth to the individual, they are a friend or a family member, but you also have obligations to them. Agape is to, could be to strangers, but philia is only to your relatives and to your best friends. And the third is Eros. And Eros is strictly about sex. It's erotic love. And that is associated most closely in Greek mythology with Aphrodite. Eros is her son.
Not so much Dionysus.
Not so much Dionysus. Okay. But that isn't to say sex didn't play a part in his religion, because he was worshipped by human women who were called maenads. And there's a wonderful play by Euripides about them called the Bacchae. And they were accused in that play by the people trying to destroy the religion of Dionysus. He's a persecuted god, very much like Jesus Christ is persecuted. And it's the same thing with Dionysus. He's persecuted. When he shows up in a community, people don't want him. They try to get rid of him. And of course, it doesn't turn out well for them. Because he's a god. And so these women are accused by their enemies of just being sexually voracious and being out there in the woods playing around with whatever or whomever. And they deny that. Dionysus denies that in the play, the Bacchae. So, I don't know, even the name of the play, the Bacchae, means the women who are Bacchus, which is another name for Dionysus, which shows the extent to which the god takes them over in this state of trance or ecstasy.
Bacchanalia.
Yes. So there was an infamous production of the Bacchae by Euripides in the 60s, in 1969, by Richard Schechner in New York. And in it, they invited members of the audience to join them in the area where they were performing. I think they got naked and all sorts of things happened that you wouldn't normally see in a polite theater. So there was always this sense, especially in the modern era, that there's something wild and crazy and sexual about this religion. But it's definitely not in, people are not in their right minds when they're worshiping Dionysus, because they're in ecstasy, they're in trance.
God of wine and...
Right, and wine puts you there, doesn't it? So it's another reason he's the god of wine, that's right. So I think the art of acting, in which a human being takes a role other than himself, and performs that role to the audience, so that Peter becomes Oedipus, or Catherine becomes Antigone, but Catherine would not have been allowed to perform in ancient Greece because she's a woman. This is ecstasy, isn't it? You're standing outside yourself. You're becoming a different personality. And that is unique, I think, to the art of theater as opposed to the art of storytelling. So it's related to that religion, and the origins of drama in that religion. But in the classical period, the oldest play we have that has survived from any culture in the world is The Persians by Aeschylus, which was written in about something like about 6 years after the Battle of Salamis. And the Battle of Salamis was fought, and I'm doing this from memory now, I think in 479. So the first performance of The Persians was around 473, something like that. So just 6 years after the end of that war, and also the Great Battle of Salamis, which was an incredible Athenian victory over the Persians at sea, a sea battle. And that is what that play is about, The Persians. So the very first play we have is about a real event that the audience actually knew. Probably most of the audience had actually fought in that battle. And we believe also that Aeschylus, who wrote the play, was a combatant. And this is an eyewitness account there in the messenger speech of the play, which describes the battle, the sea battle. It's one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, messenger speech in all of Greek drama. This is an eyewitness account of the Battle of Salamis. It's the only eyewitness account that exists from any of the Persian Wars. And so it's a very immediate and real play. Why the Athenian dramatists turned away from real topics of all the incredible things they were going through isn't entirely understood. But from that point on, the plays they wrote were fictional. And they were based on Greek heroic myths, particularly myths related to the Iliad and the Odyssey. So that Aeschylus concludes his career with his masterpiece, which is a three-part, we call that a trilogy, three-part work, three tragedies all knitted together, all telling the one big version of the same story, like a mini-series on, you know, Netflix or something. And this trilogy is based on stories from the Iliad and the Odyssey, the return of Agamemnon to his home after the conclusion of the Trojan War, and the terrible welcome that he received from his wife Clytemnestra, who killed him in the bath with an axe. And then the succeeding plays are about the vengeance of her children, and who are Electra and Orestes, against their mother. Orestes has to kill his mother as an obligation, a religious obligation, imposed on him by the god Apollo to avenge his father's death. And finally, the gods find a way out for Orestes by doing what? This is a democratic city we're having these plays in. By founding the first law court called the Areopagus, which tries murders and which is a trial by human beings. So it's jurors who are human beings, citizens of Athens, determine the fate of Orestes. I'm oversimplifying this. Somewhat. It's more complex than what I'm telling you, but it shows you that from this point on, from the 460s on, the topics that the playwrights choose are related to their mythology, to their great heroic writing tradition, the epic tradition of Homer and other writers. This is an amazing playwright, Aeschylus, because he's the most immediate and real because of the Persians. The Persians being in some ways the most primitive all the plays that have survived, and in other ways, the most sophisticated and the most real, because it tells from an eyewitness viewpoint what the horror of war is. And you can read this play in many ways, and people do read it differently, but the most attractive way for me and for most people is to read it as an anti-war play, that he's writing about the terrible suffering that come upon the Persians because of their defeat at the Battle of Salamis.
So if people think that because this is so ancient, it's somehow really stuffy and dated, they're in for a surprise.
Well, when we have a war, you know, when we had the Iraq War, guess what they were doing in New York? Productions of the Persians. And so this is an amazing thing about this ancient drama, which goes back 2,500 years. We have lost the performance tradition. We no longer restrict actors just to men. And we no longer use masks very often in the theater. It can be used, but it's not something that you see very often. Really, our audiences are used to smaller venues than the Greeks used. They were in huge theaters, which the mask enhanced their ability to be seen. But in our theaters are much smaller, and so we do not require masks. We don't use masks. We enjoy looking at the faces of the actors. The voice was sung. So first of all, singing voices usually carry better than speaking voices, although parts of these plays were spoken. But both the actors and the chorus were singing. They didn't have a sound system, that's for sure. So going back to the question of the ancient theater, they had very elaborate scenery. Some of the most famous painters of the 5th century painted for Sophocles and other Greek dramatists in the theater, did painted sets. So what the audience was looking at was a backdrop, a scene pierced by doors, which would have been very well skillfully done in however they wanted to do it. Usually sets are palaces, which means they could use the architecture of the scene building, or wild wildernesses, like in Philoctetes, a great, great play by Sophocles, also an anti-war play, set in the story of the Trojan War. This play is set in a wilderness. And there are other plays also, like Prometheus Bound, set in a wilderness. So they could do wilderness in the scene craft also. They could put on earthquakes. They could put on thunder and lightning. I mean, these sound effects are constantly being referred to, and visual effects in various plays. They're often used in the plays. So they had ways of presenting earthquakes, probably with a combination of sound and maybe actor chorus movement to suggest, or maybe parts of the scenery could fall off. Who knows how they did earthquakes, but they could. Their singing is lost to us. Their music is lost. There were only two musical instruments. The principal instrument was a double-reeded pipe called an aulos, which is frequently translated as a flute, but it was not a flute. It was a double reed. And so you have to imagine a sound, something like what the bagpipe produces, where you have a drone sound and then a melodic line above the drone. So one tube of that aulos would play the drone sound, and the other tube would play the melody. Furthermore, it was played through perpetual breathing, so that the aulos was strapped to the aulos player was the highest paid member of the performance. So the aulos player played continuously through the four plays that the dramatist was presenting in the dramatic competition. And that's another thing. These things were competitive. The Greeks were very competitive. They invented athletics, remember? Not just athletic events, but athletic competition, the Olympic Games being the most famous example of that. But there were many other competitive games. And the same thing is true of the drama. It was a competition. So when you hear actors who are receiving Oscars saying they don't really believe in competition for prizes, right, that isn't Greek. That's not classical.
Interesting.
And so going back to this whole question of sound, the aulos was played continuously so that it was strapped onto the face of the player and then never removed through all four of these performances. So a whole day of performances being given by one man musically who's playing this aulos.
And it's like a circular breathing.
It's a circular breathing. They never took the instrument out of their mouth. And that means they take air in through the nose and exhale through the pipe. And it's a technique used in certain forms of African woodwinds, and also in India, in North India. A group from Rajasthan came to UCLA, folk musicians, 1 year, and what did they have? They had what looked exactly like an aulos and was played with continuous breathing. And it was really an interesting sound, because sometimes you hear the oboe being compared to the sound of the aulos because it's a double reed, but it's not housed in two separate pipes, and it is not, doesn't have a separate drone sound as opposed to the melodic sound. But the clarinet is not the sound these Indian instruments had. They had a high-pitched sound like flutes, only it was played with this drone sound plus the melodic line above. It was extremely interesting. And there's an instrument in India called the shenai, which is more like the clarinet, which also has a double reed, but it's housed in one pipe. Now, why am I talking about India? Because it has a pretty much unbroken musical tradition in some aspects of its musical traditions that go back thousands of years.
And you have Alexander coming down.
Yeah, and you have Alexander, but that's very controversial to say the Greeks brought drama to India, because the Indians believe their drama is autochthonous, comes from their own roots.
Yeah, right.
And it's very different from...
But you have the whole Bactrian
from
culture,
Greek drama.
And maybe these instruments were related. We don't know.
We know that musicians traveled back and forth with the various... I won't use the word caravan, it's too modern, but the various merchandise that was traveling both by land and by sea between India and the Mediterranean from about the 3rd century before Christ to about the 4th or 5th century AD, just before the advent of the Muslims onto the historical scene. There was a tremendous trade going back and forth between India and the Mediterranean. And when there's trade like that, there's also religious teachers going back and forth. Buddhist monks coming to the Mediterranean. We found Buddhist symbols in Alexandria, for instance. And also Christians and Jews going the other way. There are very ancient communities of Jews. And I met the rabbi of one of them in Cochin in southern India that go back 2,000 years. They have the proof. They have copper plaques from 2,000 years ago from the local kings giving the Jews permission to settle there.
Okay, you know. Well, talk a little about...
And the Christians too, excuse me. Oh. There's a Christian tradition that St. Thomas the Apostle went to Madras, where he was martyred, and he established the first communities of Christians. And they're very ancient communities of Syrian. I say Syrian because they're under the guidance of the Patriarch of Damascus, which is a Syrian patriarchate. Christians that go back thousands of years there in India.
We'll talk a little about the relationship between chorus and actors.
Okay, so the chorus, it's a unique thing because you may call a character a chorus, as Shakespeare does in Romeo and Juliet, for instance. He has a chorus come and tell you about Verona and the tragic story of two lovers, star-crossed lovers, and their feud between their families and stuff. Or he does this also in some of his history plays. He has a chorus in Henry V that comes out and gives you the big exposition for what's happening in this history play. But this is not a chorus in the Greek sense. That's just one actor. And I've seen the French, when they do modern productions of Greek drama, they make that choice. Instead of having a chorus of the ancient chorus was started at the number 12 and then was expanded to the number 15. Instead of having for the tragic chorus, the comic chorus was even larger. It was like 32, something like that.
32 people singing.
32 people. 24. It was 24. That's what it was. The comic chorus, yeah, under Aristophanes.
And this is the general narration, the chorus.
So the chorus, when you see a play like at the Getty in Malibu with the Greek chorus, which they do beautiful, beautiful job with that, the chorus is right there. If you go in the sunshine with a student group, because they allow the students to attend daytime performances at the Getty, it's more like what the ancient Greeks saw because their performances were all in the daylight. They didn't use artificial light except as a prop. They might come on with a lit torch, but it's a prop. They might tell you it's night and they can't see anything, but it's not. It's daylight. We just accept the convention that it's dark. And so this daylight performance with the chorus turning around and facing the audience and being between the audience and the actors on a rise, which was a stage, an elevated platform of some sort, this is such a bridge between us and the fictional heroes that we're watching die and suffer and learn about fate and all of this stuff. And so really what they are is it's a form of ourselves invested in the story, thrust into the story. It doesn't mean that we see the chorus as knowing everything, of knowing how it's going to turn out, or knowing who the right person to root for is. For instance, if we saw Antigone, which is basically a combat of words and ideas between Antigone, a princess of Thebes, and her uncle Creon, who is ruling Thebes. The chorus in one scene is on Antigone's side after she said something, and then when Creon says something, which is the opposite and completely destroys what Antigone says, then the chorus is, oh, that's a good idea, that's a good point. You know, so the chorus doesn't necessarily on the side of the hero, whoever that may be, but is representing ourselves as we're watching and listening to this thing unravel. And so it's a very special device, which really no other dramatic form has.
Well, you see this type of convention used even in Commedia dell'arte, or even in Seinfeld, where Jerry, there's little bits where it shows him doing comedy and turning to the camera and doing comedy bits, which kind of narrate the story. So that chorus-like convention is still present.
It's a different way of doing the same thing. Yes.
It's the everyman voice.
Yes.
Explaining along the way.
Or not explaining, just living it and helping you live it.
Got it.
And so the sound that they made in these vast theaters, huge theaters, I mean, the classical period, probably they had a capacity, not sure what it was, because so little of the original theater has survived from the 5th century. It might have been 5,000 or 6,000, although Plato, who's alive in the 5th century and who knew Aristophanes and who knew Euripides and many other dramatists as well, whose names are known to us but we don't have their work, he said that the theater held 30,000 people. Now, that could be explained also by the fact that beyond a seating area, which maybe accommodated 6,000-7,000, then there's this very large capacious hill at the foot of the top of the Acropolis. And the theater area is abutting this very large capacious hill. So people could stand around and sit on the grass, and they didn't have to necessarily be in seats. So the capacity of it could be beyond what the archaeologists understand as the capacity. So how could they hear in these vast places? By the next century, the capacity was at least 10,000 in Athens. So how can you get your voice over to 10,000 people in that theater? And some of the theaters were as large as 30,000. And the secret is this, that they had ways of building for acoustics, which we do not understand and cannot duplicate. And we could only understand it by dismantling one of these theaters, maybe taking it apart brick by brick, and then trying to understand it by reverse engineering. And they, even then, we may not. There are some theaters, but not all of them, that have like alcoves built into some of the seating areas, and they could put a metal urn or a big metal drum in those alcoves and then cover it up with marble or whatever, and that may have enhanced the acoustics.
A little amplifier. So
it may have. But if you're in a theater of, say, like a Pitavros, whose acoustics are legendary, that has a capacity of 20,000, you're watching a play with 20,000 people are watching a play. Those people are coughing, they're sneezing, they're talking to their neighbor, they're wearing clothes, they're not nude, they're wearing clothes. They are absorbing sound. So it's one thing to examine the acoustics of a theater when it's empty, and it's another thing to examine it when it's filled with 20,000 people. And so these acoustics today are there. You can perform a Greek play or any kind of a play in a Pitavros with no sound system. No sound system whatsoever. How they did that, we don't know. We can't do acoustics as easily as that. You bring in an acoustic scientist to build your new opera house, and you're lucky if the acoustics work out.
So architecture becomes a part of theater.
That's right, absolutely. And these are multi-purpose places too, because they could use them for public assemblies or even for a place to have a public trial. They were used for all of those purposes. And under the Romans, of course, the sad truth is that they used the theaters for gladiatorial combat. They would put the gladiators in the orchestra, and they'd build barricades between the spectators and the gladiators, and they could actually stage blood sports in the theaters. But the Greeks, of course, did not do that. Now, so we don't know. They had very intense training as actors, vocally. The voice was the most important part of their instrument. The second most important part was gesture and movement and positions on stage, posing on stage. And so there were very few tragic actors, because remember the actors, there were only three of them for one play. All plays are written for a maximum of three speakers. There's one exception to that, Oedipus at Colonus, the last play Sophocles wrote. But there is probably four speakers in that play. In the comedies, it wasn't so strict. They could pull people out of the chorus probably to take small roles in the comedies of old comedy, of the 5th century comedy. Okay, so the playwrights. So Aeschylus is in some ways the greatest of them all, but we only have like 7 plays. One of them is Prometheus Bound, and some scholars think he did not write that, that it was written after his death. But it has his name attached to it. And he has 7 plays. Only one trilogy has survived, although he wrote trilogies. He liked the trilogy form. However, the Persians, the great play I told you about from 464, I think, that play was not part of a trilogy, but it was part of 3 tragedies and 1 satyr play that he would have presented. A satyr play was the 4th play that a tragic writer presented. So every tragic writer presented 4 plays, 3 tragedies and 1 satyr play.
S-A-T-Y-R.
S-A-T-Y-R. And it meant the chorus was composed of satyrs, which are the half animal, half human creatures that romp around with Dionysus in the woods.
The fauns.
They're probably half horse. In Athens, they're half horse. They wear a horse tail. So some places they're half goat. You know, so it just depends on where you are. But in Athens, they were presented in the theater as half horse. And they have pointy little ears, and they wear the phallus, which is also worn in comedy. All male characters in comedy and in the satyr plays wore the phallus, which was a costume element representing the male member. So there was a lot of humor in the satyr play. The satyr plays were body. They were always a burlesque of mythology, or usually a burlesque of mythology, and probably could burlesque the story that had just been told by the playwright.
And this is the god Pan, and also I'll point out that...
Yeah, something like that.
The image that the Christians took for... The devil.
Yes, that's right. With the cloven hooves and the pointy ears and the male member. Okay, so...
We're getting Freudian.
But this was a Freudian... I'm suggesting to you, it's very psychological. These theaters, these playwrights, the next one whose work has survived in age is Sophocles. And Sophocles was in the 19th century and most of the 20th century regarded as the premier playwright. He did not write trilogies, although we have 3 plays he wrote at different times in his life about the family of Oedipus. Oedipus the king, Antigone, and then the play about Oedipus's death, Oedipus at Colonus, which was the last play Sophocles wrote. And he was a guy who had, Aeschylus was a warrior. He was a warrior in real life. He fought in the Battle of Marathon, where his brother was killed fighting beside him. And when he died, he put on his epitaph, "Here lies Aeschylus, of whom many Medes, long-haired Medes, were afraid." So he was a warrior. I don't think I have that exactly right. I wasn't prepared to say his epitaph, but it's a very celebratory of his skills at Marathon, and then probably he also fought at Salamis. He certainly saw the Battle of Salamis. And that is what his legacy was in his own mind. And Sophocles was sort of like the Brad Pitt of drama. I mean, he was handsome, gorgeous to look at. When he was 15 years old, he performed a victory dance after the Battle of Salamis, the victory at Salamis, in the theater at Dionysus, and enchanted the entire city. He was pursued by, you know, lots of people. He was married to 2 different women. He had sons. He was elected a general of Athens. All generals were elected. He was a priest of Asclepius, the god of healing. And in every center of ancient healing, you always find a theater, because this is kind of holistic healing. They believed that performing arts, especially theater, were healing. And so he was the god that is associated with most closely with Sophocles. He won more victories than anybody. He defeated his younger rival Euripides almost every time they went up against each other. He was, he had the gifts of everything you could possibly want in life, right? Except the end, right? You never, Greek tragedy frequently says, you should never count yourself lucky until you reach your last breath. And so the end comes. He's now very old. He lives to be 90, something like that, 89 or 90. He outlives Euripides, who's a much younger man than he. He is old. He's no longer beautiful. And he's rich. And of course, as often happens to rich old people, the people around them who are going to inherit that wealth are waiting for theirs. And maybe the old guy is just hanging on too long for comfort. So his own sons go and sue him for senility, to get a hold of his estate. And he comes into court. In Athenian court, you didn't have a defense lawyer, you had to be your own lawyer. That's why they studied rhetoric as part of their education, so that if they were sued, they could argue in the courts for themselves. And he comes to court to defend himself, tottering in, an ancient old man. Very few people lived as long as he did. And his defense to the jurors is, he reads them an ode to Athens from his new play that he's working on, Oedipus at Colonus. And the jurors found him completely brilliant and at the top of his game. And really, that it's the best last play of any playwright I know. The only thing that possibly rivals it is The Tempest of Shakespeare, which is the last play Shakespeare wrote completely on his own. He collaborated a few more times after The Tempest. But this is really an incredible play about meeting your end, about coming to the end of your life, and having ungrateful sons. And that's in this play too.
King Lear too. Right?
Yeah, and King Lear, but it wasn't his. It wasn't Shakespeare's last play. So Sophocles wrote seven plays that were considered for many, many. It really, you know, who's the best playwright of the three? They're all different. He writes. He doesn't write about reality the way. And brutality, the way Aeschylus does, where a wife will kill her husband because he's unfaithful and killed her daughter. He is much more inward than Aeschylus, but without being psychological. And he's less concerned with the development of institutions the way Aeschylus is in the Persians, of defeating dictator and having democracy prevail, or in the last play of the Oresteia, the trilogy he wrote, Eumenides, the institution of a new legal system that is appropriate for democracy, in which the citizens decide who's guilty and who's innocent. And so Aeschylus is concerned with institutions. He's concerned with the darkest impulses of human nature to violence and the savagery between men and women. And in Sophocles, you find he's interested in themes like in Antigone of justice, of law, of divine law versus human law. And the divine law is clearly the law that should prevail in Antigone. Creon represents the human law, the human institution of law. And so he's a pious writer. He's a writer who's not going to shake up the institutions around him or the expectations of the audience. And that might explain his great popularity in his lifetime. The last playwright, Euripides, was almost always unsuccessful. His plays upset people. He wrote outrageous things, women murdering their children, the horrors of madness, fathers destroying their families in madness. He wrote about lust, the lust of a woman, an older woman, for a young man. Things that no one thought were appropriate in his lifetime for the theater. He wrote about the god Dionysus savagely destroying his enemies in the most upsetting way. I mean, way beyond what you think these people deserve. He wrote with magical language, with absolutely gorgeous language, and a new kind of music. He introduced a new musical form, which we can see in the meters and songs. So he gave a lot more songs, individual songs, to actors than had been done before. So the actors had big solos to sing in a new musical style that was considered more ornate. Those things we've lost. We can't hear that music. But we can imagine what a rebel Euripides was. He was an innovator, and he was going into psychological areas that were very disturbing, very, very disturbing and upsetting to the audiences. So they voted him down. Medea, which is, we consider, one of the greatest plays ever written, an amazing play in which a woman is wronged by her husband, and she takes the worst possible vengeance she can, which is to kill her own children. But a play which argues how cruel men are to women. I mean, a play that is so modern in its feminism. Or Trojan Women, the play about the great Greek victory over the Trojans, Trojan Women. The women of Troy are slaves. They're being raped. They're being murdered. They're being taken away from their home. They're watching their children being killed in front of them. That's what Trojan Women is about. So Trojan Women was written in the middle of the Peloponnesian War, just actually in a lull in between two halves of the Peloponnesian War, between Athens and its allies and Sparta and its allies. And so it's an anti-war play. It's a play critical of, in the same way the Persians was, critical of the treatment of the enemy. It's particularly harrowing because we're looking at only women and children being, the men are all dead, being treated in the worst possible way by the victor, the great Greek victors.
So not stiff or dated. This is...
So whenever we have... So these plays were mostly lost to us. And in comedy, you have extraordinary Aristophanes, who is writing about the city. So that he introduces, I don't know if you saw Barbie, Peter. Have you seen Barbie?
On my list.
Okay. Barbie is very influenced by Aristophanes.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
no,
that's
kidding.
Right. And it is
you
because,
can see it.
Yes, because in Barbie there's a war between the Ken group and the Barbie group.
Okay.
And they are each have separate governments and they're trying to take over. This is in three of Aristophanes' plays. Lysistrata, the great Lysistrata, which is another of the greatest anti-war plays ever written, in
where
which
the women
take over the Acropolis and demand and withhold sex. And the men get so horny that they cannot bear continuing the war because the wives won't allow them into their beds until they make peace with the Spartans.
So he caused a lot of waste.
So, but also when we're at war, Lysistrata is...
That was big during the Iraq War.
Absolutely. These plays are the best anti-war plays ever written. The Persians, Lysistrata, the Trojan Women, they're the best anti-war plays ever written. And they were written thousands of years ago. But it shows you what's in Greek drama is us. It's the human being, the human condition. Somehow that doesn't change. And the psychology, the deep psychology of murder, of madness, of revenge, that especially Euripides goes into It seems very modern. Now, I want to say that the fourth great Athenian playwright was Menander, and there was a famous saying by one of the Alexandrian scholars in antiquity about Menander's work: "O Menander and life, which of you imitated the other?" So Menander was considered much more realistic than any playwright that had gone before him, and he writes comedy, but he writes really what we would call dramedy. He writes about real people. The actors were wearing masks, men were playing women, so it wasn't real in the sense that we would call it real. But it was about everyday life and about the struggle of ordinary people, not in politics, but in conducting their own personal affairs. Aristophanes is about the city, about politics, about what's happening, the war. But in corruption and things of that nature, you can be sure there would be all sorts of plays about Trump and all of the other problems that we have.
Political matters.
If Aristophanes were alive today.
I see.
Yeah. This is like Saturday Night Live. But in Menander, you have sitcom, basically. You have boy meets girl, boy is crazy about girl. He gets girl pregnant, he can't marry girl for some reason or other. And the whole plot is about how these marriages between boys and girls can be arranged to satisfy the boy. The girl's feelings are never consulted, but the boy is. They deal with unwanted children who turned out to be very much wanted children. Children left out to die. The way Oedipus is in his mythology, he was left out to die because King Laius, his father, had a prophecy that his son would kill him and sleep with his mother, right? So he's left out to die. That's tragedy. And there are other examples of that in other tragedies of children left out to die who are discovered later on. A play by Euripides called Ion, which his son was left out to die, his son of the god Apollo, and by a human girl who was afraid because she was pregnant and all alone, giving birth all alone. No god was around to help her when she was giving birth, and she left the baby out to die, and the baby becomes a priest of Apollo, and she eventually is reunited with him.
Well, infanticide was a thing in ancient
days. It was a real thing, undoubtedly, because people only raised two children, usually. And there was no birth control. So it was a real problem. But the hope for those children is they're going to be discovered and brought back to some fabulous life. And that idea of mistaken identity and of the missing child that turns out to be this gorgeous girl that can marry the boy after all because she's a citizen girl. This is a Menandrian thing.
And perhaps the conflict people felt back then about killing children shows up in these plays because of this
the pain
push
of it.
And pull. Yeah.
What shows up is the pain of it, especially in the Menandrian plays, because these children are discovered and it's always a hugely emotional moment for the mother and the father and the family involved. Yeah. And adoption, another thing in Menander. There are plays in which the young man is adopted. I mean, the Greeks and the Romans too, I have to give the Romans credit, practiced adoption, which not all cultures do. You know, some cultures just, it's the bloodline, period. But they were very much people who adopted children, and that was another possibility for these little things that were left out.
Catherine Free, we have completed the first edition of our educational series. Many more to come. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Peter. Thank you for asking me.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed the wonderful Catherine Free, and we talked about Greek theater, the first of a series. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.